You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Suzanne Maloney, Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. I'm delighted to welcome all of you. On behalf of our Center for Middle East Policy and the Initiative on Non-State Armed Actors, to today's event on the future of Afghanistan and the role of the United States. This morning's discussion could not be more timely, as we've witnessed in recent months the takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban as the United States withdrew its combat forces from the country. There's been an intense discussion, especially here in Washington, surrounding the Biden administration's decision-making on Afghanistan in the aftermath. But these decisions have enormous real-time implications for Afghans and their country, and so we're especially honored to bring together today several renowned experts and practitioners to discuss the immensely important topic of the future of Afghanistan. Vonda Felbab-Brown, the director of our initiative on non-state armed actors and senior fellow in the foreign policy program at Brookings, joins us to provide her expertise on armed actors and U.S. options in dealing with the Taliban. With Vonda on screen is Fawzia Koofi, an Afghan politician and women's rights activist who is also part of the Afghan government's negotiating team with the Taliban in 2020 and 2021. We're also joined by Saad Mohsini, chairman and CEO of the Mobi Group, which includes the very influential Tolo News Channel. Finally, moderating our panel today is Madiha Afzal, fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy and our Center for Security Strategy and Technology here at Brookings. Our panel today will be discussing the Taliban's actions since taking power and what to expect regarding the future of human and women's rights, economic and counterterrorism policies, as well as the role of the media in and on Afghanistan. We will be taking questions from viewers, which can be submitted via email to events@brookings.edu or via Twitter at #futureofafghanistan. With that, I'll hand the mic over to Madiha. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Suzanne, and thank you all for joining us in the audience, and of course to our esteemed panel, Saad, Fawzia, and Vonda. As Suzanne said, you know, there are questions about how we got here. You know, the heartbreak of August when Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. I think that fall reflects nothing less in my mind than a collective failure on the parts of many successive U.S. administrations, Afghan leaders, Afghanistan's neighbors. That the Taliban is in power 20 years after the U.S. defeated them in 2001, we should be clear, is shocking. And from a U.S. perspective, and from that of many Afghans who wanted a different future for themselves, it's hard to imagine a worse outcome. But litigating the past and the war would be its own panel. And this is a week when congressional hearings are ongoing on the topic. The question we have before us for this panel today is about the present and about the future of Afghanistan and how the U.S. can engage with it going ahead. I could not think of three panelists better positioned to have this discussion with and who can shed light on this topic, given their deep on-the-ground expertise on Afghanistan. So without further ado, I'll begin this discussion. The first overarching question that I have for all our panelists will be on the Taliban's actions since taking power and what we can expect on various issues. On women's rights, on girls' education, on the media, the economy, the issue of counterterrorism, and the Taliban's connection with Al-Qaeda and its dealing with ISIS-K. Essentially, how should we expect the Taliban to govern or to transition to governing, really, given what we have seen so far and what we know about its history? So Fawzia, if it's all right, I would love to start with you. And in addition to anything else that you would like to bring up, if you could, in particular, please address the question of women's rights and girls' education. What can we expect from the Taliban regarding the inclusion of women in public life in Afghanistan? Their interim cabinet announced this month does not include any women. Girls have not been allowed to go back to secondary school in Afghanistan, though boys have been. It's day 11 of boys returning to secondary school today. Well, girls have not been. And women are largely not back at work, especially in government offices. So would welcome your input on this and anything else you would like to add to begin.
Thank you, Madiha, and I'm very delighted to be with such a distinguished panelist, Saad Mohseni, a very influential figure, also running one of the most popular TV channels, Tolo. For me, women's rights is not just a political or social issue, although in Afghanistan it has always been a political issue. But for me, it's a matter of national security in the case of Afghanistan, because women's rights and their liberation could be regarded as a benchmark for how the governments or the power in Kabul will deal with, the cause of freedom, basically, the freedom of media, the freedom of speech, the freedom of voting, how a government acts on the principles of democratic values is basically directly linked to how they deal with women. And that's how I look at it. So it's not just a corner issue of women's rights, but it's a matter of how the country's future politics is shaped. If the Taliban try to, accept women as a reality of Afghanistan, and one of the reality as the Taliban are also another reality, like Taliban, women are also a reality of Afghanistan. If they try to accept women as a first-class citizens and learn to coexist with women, that means they can live with, principle with the globe, to the minimum with global principles of coexistence in the world. And so, therefore, I would like to really put strong benchmarks. So far, despite Taliban's generic media statements, or even during the negotiations we have had, that I was personally engaged with them in different dialogues and events since 2019. And the first time when I actually met Taliban after their government collapse in 2019 in February, one of the Taliban leader who is now in Kabul, part of the negotiation, he was then, clearly mentioned their position about women's rights and the future of women in Afghanistan if they come to some sort of power sharing. And he said, from their perspective, there is no problem and no contradiction if women become, politically engaged up to the level of foreign minister, prime minister, and hold cabinet positions, get engaged in business, education, etc. It does not contradict Islam. But on the contrary, actually, when they took power, we all know that they have started from the scratch, basically. They put us back to where we were, making us invisible, literally. In terms of women's political participation, we know that there is no constitutional order. The parliament is kind of on hold. We don't know if we have a parliament. The parliamentarians are still elected bodies, but there is no parliament. Women in the civil servants were asked to stay home until further notice, until the environment, as quote unquote, is safe for them. A woman from primary school onward, secondary and high school, are asked to stay at home because their interpretation of the issues are that when women are beyond, or girls are beyond 12 years old, grade 6, then they become mature enough, and for a male teachers to teach them is un-Islamic. And therefore, they want to make the situation according to what they say, in a way that women are able to, that the students have, that there are enough girls, female teachers, which we don't have enough female teachers to teach only girls and enough male teachers to teach only boys. Everything that they do right now, we know that actually contradicts not only what they say, but also contradicts the principles of Islamic belief. Because how could they claim that they are actually doing everything under the name of Islam, while the same religion starts with Iqra, means read. The first word that came to our Prophet, peace be upon him, said Iqra, read. Reading and writing is the principle of Islam. So therefore, they're doing everything based on a traditional, very conservative view of traditional aspect. During the negotiation also, they try to demonstrate a moderate view and were regarding the four women negotiator as politicians. But what I see is disappointing. I hope these are temporary measures moving forward. I hope that the Taliban understand that women are unavoidable part of the society and no government, even in the Muslim countries. In the Muslim countries, look at this, in the same country that Taliban had their office, Qatar, they have more female in school than male, actually. And they have women at all levels of social and political sphere. So I think they claim that this is a temporary measure, but my concern is that that's what exactly they did when they first came to power in 1996. The temporary measures became permanent then. But the good thing is that we have an opportunity. It's a caretaker kind of government. I hope with the social uprising and civilian disobedience that we see nowadays, being formed in Afghanistan, which I'm hoping to join them soon, we will be able to hopefully pressurize the Taliban to accept and learn to live in diversity and difference.
Thanks so much, Fawzia. That is exactly right. You know, the fact that they're saying that their measures are temporary, but this is exactly what happened in the 96 to 2001 timeframe. And you bring up a few really essential points. I think one is the role of civil society and what role can it play in terms of protest movements. Of course, you know, the Taliban, when they announced their interim cabinet, the first round on September 7th, the day after that, they said essentially that any spontaneous protests would not be allowed to take place unless they were pre-approved a day in advance, and especially in terms of sort of topics and slogans, effectively trying to quash civil dissent. But certainly Afghanistan is not the same as it was 20 years ago. And of course, Saad will speak, I'm sure, more to the role of the media. So that is really essential. And I think that the second point, and I'll ask this to all the panelists, is what can we say about the Taliban's leadership itself, right? So the Taliban's leadership certainly may not all see eye to eye on these issues. So there's a question of what the Taliban spokesperson is saying, those who are talking to the international media are saying, those ostensibly more moderate are saying, and then there's the question of, you know, what is being implemented in practice. So if you could also highlight that in your answers, that'd be great. But Saad, I'll turn to you with the same overarching question. You know, what do we see from the Taliban right now, and what can we expect? And specifically for you, in addition to anything else, you know, the role of the media. So how has the Taliban been with Tolo News? And what role do you expect the media to play going forward in holding the Taliban to account? And of course, we know they've been targeting journalists, you know, the lashing of the journalists from Itilat Rose, so that's a concern. If you can just sort of speak to those issues, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madia. Well, as most things, it's not that black and white. Yes, we've had journalists beaten, apprehended over the last 5 weeks. But that was also the case during the Ghani administration, and that was also the case during the Karzai administration. As a matter of fact, 3-4 months ago, one of our journalists was badly beaten. Where I was forced to ring the Minister of Interior and have a very honest chat with him as to why this was allowed to happen. And they also failed to prosecute the police officer who physically assaulted one of our people. So for us, this is nothing new. We had 6 or 7 people arrested during the Karzai time, one for 2 weeks. One time they held my brother in the intelligence agency for 2 days. So this is not unusual for us. The problem is today we have no safety nets, whereas in the past we had friends in government, we had friends in parliament. We could rely on some of the judges if we were, you know, once we were indicted, we had the international community. Today we have, we operate without any safety nets. And there is absolutely little doubt that the Taliban is going to become more restrictive. Initially, I think in the first few days, they had little bandwidth. They're beginning to get on top of their game. They have a ministry. They have a minister in charge. They have a deputy minister in charge. They're starting to issue directives to media and others in civil society. However, are the Taliban different? Well, if you freeze, if you're judging the Taliban by how they are today, yes, they are different. A, there's a media that didn't exist in the 1990s. There was no TV in the 1990s. So there's now dozens of TV channels. We have dozens of radio stations in addition to the state broadcaster. We have men and women who are on our various radio networks as well as in front of the camera, certainly on Tolo and Tolo News and Lemar TV. We have the Taliban being forced to defend their positions, whether it's on women's rights or the fighting that happened in Panjshir, human rights abuses. Various reports that are coming out that we always address and we highlight. But that's, you know, to assume that this will continue. If things in 6 months are the way they are today, then that's a success. I'm not sure if that's if we can maintain what we have today in 6 months' time. But what's interesting is that I think we've discovered that the Taliban is not one organization, one movement. Unlike the 1990s, they don't have this leader in Mullah Omar. It's a more fragmented movement. We have the Haqqanis, we have the groups from Kandahar, and we have others. We have the Iranians backing certain individuals, the Pakistanis backing others. There are others certainly closer to Russia. So there is, perhaps there are opportunities as well. I think that what's important, and I was in Washington last week, and my message was you have to engage. You have to engage with the Taliban leadership. You have to use what leverage you have for the benefit of the, you know, 30-odd million Afghans stuck inside the country. The priority right now seems to be evacuating 10 or 20,000 people, and the worst thing they could do would be to give away every, you know, bit of leverage they have in order to secure evacuating these individuals, but then in 6 months we left with nothing besides perhaps recognition of the new regime. So engaging is very important. I think the Americans need to have a longer term, you know, bigger picture policy. Disengaging right now, I don't think is good for us. It's not good for the rest of the country. And as we've seen in other parts of the world, the regime is usually the last to suffer. And Afghanistan today is facing a political, humanitarian, and now an economic crisis. It's so bad that something like 90%+ of the population will be under the poverty line if this continues. So media-wise, I think they're doing an extraordinary job, our folks in Kabul, not just our outlets, but other outlets. They're speaking truth to power. And the Taliban are responding by holding press conferences, by coming on TV and responding, by reacting. For example, the beating of the journalists was, you know, they apologized, sort of. They certainly investigated one of the people who had physically assaulted one of our reporters, two of our reporters, and they tried to find the camera and the phone that was confiscated. So these are positive baby steps. And for them to change, I think ongoing pressure and engagement, carrot and stick approach is probably one that we need to see from everyone.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that nuanced and that very detailed picture. And we'll certainly come back to the question of engagement and how to engage from the U.S. perspective, from the Western perspective, as well as, try to talk about the region a little bit towards the end as well. Vanda, I'll turn to you now. Again, same overarching question. I was wondering if I could also add on your thoughts, ask you to add on your thoughts about the Taliban's interim government, you know, both the initial sort of few appointments that were announced on September 7th and then the added appointments announced more recently. Of course, they've expanded from the initial appointments announced to include more ethnic groups, still no women. If you could also speak to, Saad addressed the economic and humanitarian crisis, obviously that Afghanistan is facing. What are the challenges that the Taliban faces in terms of sort of dealing with the economy, the banking sector? The central bank is effectively frozen. Dealing also with terrorist groups such as ISIS-K that want to attack the Taliban, and dealing with an Al-Qaeda that might want to, reprise itself in a way that might sort of hold the Taliban back in terms of its engagement with the international community. So if you could address, any of those questions that you would like to as well. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Madiha. I'll pick up maybe with Saad's point about the Taliban having all kinds of internal cleavages. And indeed, the role that we have seen so far, the set of decisions that we have seen are really primarily driven by the Taliban's desire to reduce those cleavages that have become amplified by the fact that they won and that they need to make policy decisions. Indeed, the Taliban knew that those cleavages existed and in many ways avoided making all kinds of definite policy pronouncements, including thinking about what the cabinet would look like for months, both because they did not expect they would win that quickly. They were as shocked as anyone by the speed of their takeover, although they were assuming they would take over, and because they wanted to punt the really problematic internal bargaining. So we are seeing a set of cleavages. On the one hand, there is the Baradar Yaqub Siraj Haqqani line and division. It's more complex than that. There are all kinds of satellite actors around that impact on the triangle, but for our purposes, that's one set of divisions. Another set of divisions is the Kandahari versus Helmand Taliban factors. Again, more complicated. We are already seeing cleavages and different alliances between Kilzai, Pashtun, more associated with Yaqub, and Durrani, more associated with Baradar. A third line of division is some of the political leadership, the Rabari Shura versus some of the military commanders and sheikhs, people like Zakir, who have now been brought into at least deputy positions, but again, more complicated than that. And Saad mentioned that international actors interact in different ways with their particular clients or at least sought after clients in the same way that they were trying to do during the Ghani and Karzai regimes. But the internal divisions and the uncertainty over the divisions has really pushed the Taliban to two principal forms of governance responses. One is to punt on any difficult questions, particularly economic questions, and essentially not govern on that space. Govern in the areas where they are comfortable governing, which is suppressing crime. They have been rather successful in doing so. Places like Kabul, but not just Kabul, Herat, are much safer in terms of the reduced amount of kidnapping, the reduced amount of robberies. Of course, women often feel very insecure to go out on the street, certainly in the absence of being covered, even with the burqa. They've also achieving some impressive effects on reducing corruptions, including at customs. Long something they have an experience with. They're very effective in taxing any part of Afghan economy. But the flip side to that is that they have also taken very rigid positions on all kinds of issues of personal freedoms, civil liberties, and social restrictions. And as Saad said, those are hardening by the day. And frankly, I don't expect that we will see loosening very rapidly. And in the second part, we can talk about what is or is not, in fact, both domestic and international leverage to effectuate some sort of loosening. you know, in my time in Afghanistan, when I was studying the shadow rule of the Taliban, so when Taliban was the de facto authority, we really see a tremendous continuity from how their shadow rule evolved into what they are adopting at the national level, including in the hardening of policies on national freedoms, on personal freedoms, on civil liberties. So progressive hardening of those, particularly in the initial phases as they try to establish rule. But often there is space for local communities to push back. And whether local communities are effective in pushing back depends on both the idiosyncrasy of local Taliban officials. In some ways, this has changed because now there is more central directive, and it's a still very centralist government, though hardly omnipresent and omnipotent. And it depends on local communities' cohesion and, frankly, its courage, because often the Taliban is not welcoming of community pushback and suggest that people have no right to complain. So that's a line that they frequently use in the shadow governance. And so it depends really on how close the commander is to the or the shadow governor in this case now, not shadow, just official governor is to local communities. Or not. Let me make a few comments on the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. To get the Taliban to disavow Al-Qaeda, to sever its links against Al-Qaeda, really required that the Taliban would be defeated. The Taliban never promised that in the Doha Agreement. They merely promised that they will not allow terrorist attacks from Afghanistan against external countries. That was not a random wording on the part of the Taliban. It was well reflecting their sensitivities about breaking with Al-Qaeda, both because so many low-level and middle-level Al-Qaeda operatives are intermarried into Taliban families, and because of the international jihadi, that's an obligation they face, and they would lose if they were to break with that. Those are even more important for them now as they are grappling with international sanctions, something I'll talk more in the second round. But let me just say that the more they fear sort of the fist of international sanctions, the more they are actually going to be leaning toward not jeopardizing some of the international jihadi networks they have. The Islamic State is a different bag. It's an actor that the Taliban has been actively battling since late 2015. Often the Taliban has had the most important successes, far greater than the Afghan government, in limiting the Islamic State. But it's still there, and it will be a challenge for them in urban spaces. In conclusion to my opening comments, let me just say that we are not in the beginning of July and we are not in March. The Taliban is an authoritarian government, and it would always be an authoritarian government. Any kind of notion that we can somehow preserve or in this case, resurrect the freedoms as they existed, in my view, is not realistic. On the most sort of expansive element that with greatest sort of liberties and systems that we could look at would be an Iran-like system, something that you have elements within the Taliban that have been asking for it. At the same time, when the Iran-like propositions came out in late August, early September, in the decisions about the formation of the government, those actors within the Taliban who advocated the position were slapped quite strongly back. So we're really looking at a rule that's 1990s-like in its most hideous and egregious form. On the one hand, some sort of Saudi authoritarianism, Central Asian authoritarianism in the middle, and an Iran-like system. At this point, the Iran-like system is a long reach, and it will take considerable amount of time, in my view, before we get there. And to the extent that we get there, it will come more from within, including the fear of implosion and economic implosion, rather than from the ability of the international actors to really instigate that significantly. Thanks.
Excellent. Thanks, Vanda, for that sobering and yet, you know, very, very realistic account of where we stand. I'll just encourage those in the audience. We've already been receiving your excellent questions. You can continue to email them to events@brookings.edu or on Twitter with the hashtag Future of Afghanistan. About 10 minutes before the end, about 10:50, we'll get to some of those questions. But of course, they're being woven into this discussion as well. I'll turn now to sort of the second overarching question I have for all three of our panelists, and that is the question of engagement. And in particular, I'd like to start with the U.S. and Western engagement. You know, Fawzia and Saad, you've, of course, been interacting with governments in Europe as well. So feel free to please bring that in as well. But I think the question is, what are the policy tools? What are the levers at the disposal of the international community, in particular the West, thinking about the U.S., thinking about Europe, in terms of thinking about aid, sanctions, the issue of legitimacy and recognition, humanitarian assistance, to moderate the Taliban and to influence its behavior? And I think, you know, there are, I guess, two questions there in my mind. You know, what can the West do? What should it do in engaging with the Taliban? And then, of course, there's the question of the ordering of this. You know, as all of you have alluded to, there's a dire economic and humanitarian, collapse, essentially, that is imminent in Afghanistan. So does the West engage on these issues, given that the urgency of the economic situation there? But does that then threaten the conditionality of that engagement, right? And so how realistic is the leverage that the West has given the challenges Afghanistan faces? So I'll start off with you, Vanda, then move to Saad and Fawzia.
Well, thank you. Let me first make a very sort of strong pitch for engagement. Any kind of hope that isolation, blanket sanctions a la Myanmar, a la Venezuela will bring about radical changes in Afghanistan are, in my view, incorrect reading of the situation. They will push the Taliban toward being more uncooperative, rigid. The regime itself has financial tools to survive by taxing both legal and other illegal economies. It has countries that will not join in this kind of sanctions regimes, including Russia and China, not to mention the Gulf, while the population will suffer. So sort of blanket isolation, so-called maximum pressure, designing sanctions a la Myanmar, Venezuela, in my view, will be deeply counterproductive and ineffective. Yet this is what a lot of politics within the United States in European countries are driving towards. So the political pressures, in my view, are heading in ways that pushes policy in the counterproductive dimension. That said, I think there is a way to engage, to have a smart engagement that allows some inducements, that is not just about sticks. As long as engagement is all about sticks, I think we are back to sort of this false notion of maximum pressure that will not produce outcomes. But nonetheless, a combination of positive inducements, such as allowing some money accounts, not all, some to be flowing for particular actions, can nudge, and I use the term carefully here, the Taliban toward less egregious policies. And this is really important. If we assume that the purpose of pressure is to return to the gains, to the political freedoms as they existed until end of July, we will be disappointed. The pressure will be for nothing. In my view, both positive and pressure should be toward minimizing the most egregious policies and understanding that it will take time for policy direction to take place, and that often policy change will need to emerge from local communities. That, however, means that local communities need to have some means of survival and cohesion and mobilization. To the extent that as a result of collapsed economy and Western pressure, they are simply in condition of starvation, the communities will be far less effective in pushing back and mobilizing. That's another illusion, in my view. There is a hope in some circles that if there is an implosion in Afghanistan, which frankly economically could take place next year, quite rapidly next year, sort of November, December are real headlines where we will see massive collapse of already deficient but still functioning basic economic and humanitarian systems, that this implosion will undo the Taliban and we are in some sort of happy scenario. I would posit that yes, we could head into an explosion, but it will probably be even worse scenario than we are right now. Allowing humanitarian aid is thus critical. It is extremely hampered both by politics and by legal issues. Essentially, most of the money streams have dried up and it's extremely difficult to get them in. Part of that is politics and this notion that maximum pressure will produce radical changes that's sort of easier to undone. Part of it is the legal regime that's restricting aid. So moving money off budget, figuring out ways that international NGOs can bring money in, or looking at other roundabout systems around the legal aid, in my view, is critical to just ease the humanitarian situation. Saad talked about 90% of people being in poverty. That number was there before the Taliban took over. That number comes from really early 2021. We're probably in a worse situation right now, and we're heading into far situation by then. So, you know, my big sort of takeaways are engagement is crucial. Engagement should take place with a wide set of actors within the Taliban. Talk with everyone in the Taliban. What we ask for realistically needs to be very limited, really shaping policy away from the most disastrous dimensions and keeping humanitarian aid coming in.
Excellent. Over to you, Saad.
I agree with Vanda. I think... but before I talk about engagement, which I think is crucial, we have to ask ourselves what is given that Brookings is a U.S. based institution, what is the post August 15 U.S. policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan? To be frank with you, I don't think there is a policy today, and I think that's really important for folks in Washington to figure out. How they intend dealing with issues such as, Afghanistan's humanitarian needs, how intense tackling issues like narcotics and terrorism and refugees, which is going to impact the Europeans more than the Americans. But nonetheless, it's a very important consideration. But also, I think it's important for the Americans to also work towards, they have to strive to protect our gains, of the last 20 years, including women's rights, education, and free expression. Now, when we talk about engaging the Taliban, I think the important thing is you can always go back to the carrots. You have this window of opportunity, which may be 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks to engage with the Taliban. Because if the Taliban are isolated and cornered, they will go to their default mode, which is sort of a Pol Pot type approach to things. And it's going to strengthen the more radical elements within the movement, the isolationists, the people who don't really care about the local populace. And the ones who will think, well, we have to sort of go back to being dictatorial because this is the only way we can manage this country. But if you engage, then you're giving the Taliban some hope. And they have to, the ultimate aim should be to recognize them if they, do a whole series of other things. That should certainly be indicated to them. And I'm not saying that engagement today should mean recognition, but engagement. And then if the Taliban do a series of things, eventually you could recognize them. And certainly that should be promised. The other important thing is engaging the region. You have to engage the Chinese. You have to engage the Pakistanis and the Russians and the Iranians, because there are some common interests, whether it's ISIS or refugees or drugs. I think these parties are willing to get engaged. And I think there is this sort of buyer's remorse to an extent, I think, especially with the Russians and the Chinese and perhaps even the Iranians. To a large extent, they wanted the Americans to fail. But now that the Americans have failed, they're stuck with the Taliban. They're right next door. So I think talking to them is important. The other thing which I wanted to point out is when we talk about leverage, the Americans have to figure out how to become relevant again. Humanitarian aid should not be used as leverage, to be honest with you, but there are other levers, I'm sure. And I think for the Taliban, they've emerged victorious. Their victory has been absolute. They're very confident, cocky, but it's like winning a football game and not quite realizing how badly you've injured your knee. And I think that they will hobble in the weeks ahead when they realize how difficult it will be to manage Afghanistan, which last year received something like $8.5 billion, 45% of its GDP, compliments of the international community. So I think the weeks ahead, they will realize that this is a country very different to the one in 2001. It has almost doubled in size. People's expectations are very high, that 90% who lived on the poverty line in 2001 could get by. They were entrepreneurial in a lot of ways. They had different Afghanistan to the one we saw last in 2001. And they will suffer a lot more. And in some ways, they're a bit more spoiled. Many, many years of international assistance. They will stand up for themselves, I think, to allow, I'm certain we're not going to see street combat, but they will have protests and they will attempt to get out. They will make things difficult for the Taliban. So this ongoing engagement will allow for, you want to keep the door slightly open as the Taliban realize that they need help.
Yes, thank you. And I think, the sort of the what's emerging is, of course, humanitarian aid should not be used as leverage and sort of the importance of engagement. I think the question with the Taliban always is if you sort of give them too much unconditionally, then what happens? And of course, the Taliban have lost a lot, any goodwill that they had, given sort of the fact that with the Doha Agreement, they did not abide by sort of the notion of cutting ties with Al-Qaeda, though, as Wanda pointed out, that was not how they read it. They read it as not allowing Al-Qaeda to conduct attacks from Afghan soil on the U.S. Fauzia, over to you. Same question, the question of engagement. And Saad, of course, also brought up the region. So if you want to weave that in, but I will ask that to the panel directly as well, sort of the question of China, Russia, and Pakistan.
On the question of engagement and the future policy, I think any kind of engagement with Taliban must consider a few points. First, as somebody who have been engaged personally in the whole thing, not just the theoretical studies, but also personal experience. First of all, these are the Taliban that are detached from governing. And they are basically owning a country that is so different from 1996. They are actually owning a country that only up to a few weeks ago, the institutions were functional. Yes, with problems, inefficiencies, but institutions were functional. And people expectation, as stated before, are high. So their engagement actually have to, any sort of engagement must address that issue of Taliban. That is a group does not know how to govern. This is a group that is very good in fighting. Now, do they have that required experience and expertise on governance? Time will prove it. And until now, we know that they have not also been able to utilize resources outside their own network. So I think that is one aspect of any future policy. It's a fighter group. And the moment they face a military confrontation or any sort of confrontation, it will unite them. And that's why you see that they, in any kind of guerrilla fight, including the Panjshir, they won. But are they going to be as united as they are or they were before moving forward? There were talks about disunity and different fraction groups about this. And I know that, for instance, when their first military group entered Kabul, the Haqqani network, the political office in Qatar and others are not happy about what has happened. And they seem to be less relevant in terms of making the important decisions. So already we see that there is disunity moving forward when matters of governing and resources, et cetera, and power and position comes up. Are they going to be as united as they were when they were in opposition or in a smaller group fighting? And I think when it comes to international pressure, unlike what Banda believe, I believe that international pressure actually will work because they seem to be more sensitive towards international pressure. So, and that's why they try to behave to the extent, although in contradiction to their belief and inner kind of structure, they try to behave to the extent they can and respond to these protests, civil protests and freedom of speech, because they are in desperate desire of the international recognition for them to survive. They know that China and Russia will not substitute EU when it comes to humanitarian or any kind of funding in the future for them to govern. So therefore, I think they're extremely cautious about what the world perspective is towards them. And that's why we have seen that in the past few days, I think it was a week ago, that one of the Haqqani members went to Sirena spontaneously, had a press conference, invited media, international media, to get out of Sirena hotel in Kabul and to see the real life, because that indicates how, you know, international recognition is important for them. So for that, I think they will take international pressure to some extent. So I think international pressure on inclusion, on rights and liberties, on a constitutional order, on you know, moving forward on how they behave towards religious minorities and others, especially women, will work from my perspective. And second or third rather, on you know, military extremist groups and their ties. Let's not forget that in 2001 or even before that, there was Al-Qaeda and Taliban, the two military extremist strong military extremist groups in Afghanistan. But now there are more than based on some security reports published, 22 military extremist groups operate between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, in addition to Al-Qaeda and ISIS-K. Their attitudes and behavior in Afghanistan towards ISIS was also different from one region to the other. I know that in East, for instance, in Nangarhar, they were in military confrontation with ISIS, but in places like, even Saripol and Badakhshan in northeast, they were in working in partnership in some cases. So moving forward, those unhappy soldiers who only know how to fight. And when I was in Kabul, I actually met some of those uneducated young boy who have gained identity through fighting. And the only thing that actually they believe in is the gun. Moving forward, when they are more established and there is less space for those military fighters or their soldiers, foot soldiers, how are they going to accommodate them? Are they going to be another, you know, recruitment source for ISIS in this case, or another military as extreme Taliban that probably will raise, or even the military resistance against Taliban? Are they going to recruit them? So that is another question which could pose Afghanistan to the rise of military extremist groups. And also, as you rightly said, in the Doha Agreement, which also the United States violated in a way, because the agreement says clearly that intra-Afghan negotiation for a political settlement, something that the Biden administration bypassed by announcing withdrawal as early as 31st of August or September even, which resulted in, unprepared withdrawal, collapse of institutions. So are they going to, abide themselves to an agreement which the United States actually violated itself in terms of detaching to some of these military extremist groups, and in this case ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which I mentioned before. Their approach towards ISIS also differs from one region to the other. With all of this being said, I think my concluding remarks on this part would be that international pressure is important. There is a very narrow line between how the world will engage and how they give political boost and support, and how they misuse that engagement. Because I know that in the recent trip of one of the Minister of Foreign Affairs to Afghanistan, they actually stated in their social media that they have been using extremely well, much better than the previous government in their PR. They said that that minister is there to congratulate. So one has to really consider this narrow line of engagement. I also think that the world needs to engage with them to ensure that they genuinely commit themselves and do what they commit in terms of inclusion, because inclusion is a very wide definition. Inclusion does not mean somebody is a deputy minister and then that's inclusion. It has to be meaningful decision-making process. Something that, as Saad Mohsini said, in the previous government was also a major issue. And I think one of the reasons that the government collapsed was the fact that people did not see themselves being included. And when I, in my personal meetings with people from the police and army, when I asked them the question, the same response was like, why should we fight to protect Ghani's interests? So I think that was a question before, and it's a question now. Inclusion is a wide issue. How do we tackle that moving forward? We all have a responsibility. The international community, I think, need to monitor, put that as a benchmark, because if it's an inclusive government with women, with religious minorities, etc., that means it's a government that is willing to work with the world. The role of the region, who knows, in a year time, in the same background airspace that there was a American flag last July, which flag will be in a year time? No one knows. The Chinese, of course, following the footstep of some of the neighboring countries, try to have a good relationship. They use the most in the region, they use the most out of the deal Americans have had with the Taliban, and the removal of lifting of sanctions for Taliban to be able to travel. But that was particularly for the negotiation. They used the most of it. The region used it. Taliban used it. I think they will try to remain engaged. But now, are they going to substitute the funds, the political support the US and the EU can give? That's a question that we will see how their financial support will change the status quo, the situation. In terms of the way they govern, the corruption, etc., let's remember that they have been dealing with a very minor way of governing. They only have been controlling the tax and the customs, not more than that. Moving forward, we will see how these issue of corruption, governance, etc., will unfold. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Fawzia. And so to that question of the region, Fawzia, you and Saad have addressed it a little bit. But again, I'd invite both Wanda and Saad, if you want to jump in on this question. And this is something we're getting from the audience as well. And I'll add on a little bit to that. So thinking of regional actors, Russia, China, Pakistan, can the West and the U.S. interact with them as the international community to put pressure on the Taliban? So, basically act in concert with them? Or will we see basically Russia, China, Pakistan, perhaps Iran, acting separately in a way that might counter the West's interests in putting pressure on the Taliban? So perhaps they put less pressure on the Taliban. Perhaps they're more, there's an earlier recognition that comes from them that counteracts sort of what the West's leverage is and policy levers are. How do you see the U.S. interacting with Pakistan, Russia, China to put pressure on the Taliban?
Would you like me to go first? Just, I think very quickly, I think there's an expectation from the U.S. to clean up this mess. And this was communicated to folks in Kabul by the three special envoys who were there a few days ago. I think the Americans probably, if it was up to the White House, they'd probably cut and run. And the Chinese and the Russians in particular were very vocal that the Americans need to come back and, you know, and help us clean this mess up. I think one option should be through a UN special envoy. I think if the Americans take the lead role, I think they're people are too suspicious of the Americans. And I think the Americans should re-engage and, of course, talk to the Russians and the Chinese, Pakistanis, and even the Iranians on the Afghan issue, as well as the Central Asians and others. But perhaps, not like before, perhaps there should be a special envoy, a UN Security Council, you know, appointed individual who could oversee this. And maybe there's an opportunity to have another forum, like a Bonn-type forum, where they can discuss Afghanistan's issues and also invite the Taliban, as well as maybe perhaps some opposition figures who could perhaps join the Taliban. You know, what we intended doing back in Qatar, maybe they can make it, have another go with it. I think we have to think outside the box. I think the way things are going, it's not positive. The signs are not good. I think as Vander pointed out, but maybe there is an opportunity as well. And I think the realization in the neighborhood that this could really be expensive for us, you know, I think certainly that's what the Russians are saying privately, and even the Chinese, but and the Pakistanis as well. I think there's a realization that if this explodes, who's going to suffer the most? It's going to be the region.
I think that's exactly right. That recognition is certainly coming to bear. And with Pakistan, of course, you know, there's sort of the threat of terrorism in terms of the TTP and other groups as well. So real concerns there. Vanda?
Yeah, you know, I think that is a sort of basic and profound policy dilemma that we touched on in many ways. And that is exercising maximum pressure or intense pressure through all kinds of isolations and sanctions, and the risk of implosion potentially happening quite quickly, or at least very significant worsening just of the daily conversation of the daily life of people without really moving the Taliban toward more constructive policies. I would also say that, you know, this notion that the region can somehow come together and rescue Afghanistan from various layers of problems has been there for years and years, including in the run-up to Doha, before Doha. And while the region technically has very same interest, the alignment of interest and even the ordering of preferency really never translated into unified policies. Russia certainly, and I would say China as well, expect the West to move away from the extent of economic sanctions. They don't like it. Russia recently said it will not recognize the Taliban anytime soon, and in fact raised issues of women and political inclusion more I had expected Moscow to do. But at the same time, they also said we want, or privately they're saying they don't like the blanket sanctions as they exist right now. China is already starting to move in with some in-kind aid. It's still very minimal, but it's happening. I would, however, also point out that the Taliban is actually very suspicious of not just the West, and that it often interprets pressure as a sign of efforts to undermine and destroy the Taliban. It is also very suspicious of those other actors, including of Pakistan. So Pakistan, you know, is often seen as this big victor, and in many ways it is. It's sponsored the Taliban for 30 years. It's managed to insert itself and people that are closest to Pakistan, like the Haqqanis, into all kinds of really important portfolios in the restructuring of the Ministry of Intelligence, the defense and security forces. But at the same time, there is also lots of pushback, lots of frustration, lots of suspicion on the part of various Taliban actors, even of Pakistan. So I think we have to be cautious. While engaging the region is very important, certainly talking with the region and having the U.S. be part of the conversation, we have to be both cautious of how much we expect the unity will emerge and how much we can expect that even if there is unity, it will really bring radical changes. And so this is what I go back to. You know, in my view, the most important policy point to figure out is how much is realistic to ask for. And if the ask is too large, we will fail, or there is at least the risk that we will fail. But of course, that's a difficult calibration, and often politics and other pressures drive asking for much more than might perhaps be accomplished. My final comment is really to emphasize the role of the UNAMA office in Afghanistan that's been tremendous and essential. And to the extent that there is really any kind of Western presence right now left on the ground, any kind of engagement with the Taliban, any kind of engagement with people, it is the UN office, the UNAMA office. And they need strength and support as opposed to threats and pressure regarding legal constraint, regarding to being too forward-leaning, perhaps, in engaging with the Taliban. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you so much again to Saad, to Vanda, to Fauzia for an incredibly nuanced, incredibly rich, sobering, but also hopeful discussion. You know, this was certainly very constructive. And you know, as Saad said, the U.S. needs to come up with a policy for the future for Afghanistan. And certainly the Biden administration needs to come up with a cohesive policy that, you know, sort of brings together the international community. And of course, we talked about the role of the UN. We've talked about sort of the complications with the region, but the potential with the region as well. But we will certainly be watching this at Brookings closely. Again, this event co-hosted by the Center for Middle East Policy and our Initiative for Non-State Armed Actors. We'll be keeping our eyes on this. Thank you so much for your engagement in terms of the audience. Your questions, again, show a great deal of concern and interest on this topic. So please continue to follow our work on this, and we will be following this as well. Thank you so much again to our panelists and to the audience for joining us.